Good day. Today is Saturday, 28th February 2026. And before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. If once you've watched and listened to this programme or whichever part of this programme you want to watch or listen to, you decide that you like what you've heard and you wish to indicate that fact. Now, today, I should say specifically this day, I am under intense time pressure. I've already done a live stream on the Duran discussing the attack on Iran, which will be the main topic, obviously, of today's programme. But one way or the other, I'm going to have to make this a shorter programme than usual. I know that I've said this many times, but on this occasion, I'm afraid I'm going to have to stick to that. In any event, the events that are playing out today across Iran and the Middle East are at an early stage, and it's probably better to discuss them in more detail after a few hours when we have more information as to what exactly it is that is taking place. Having said this, I think a number of things perhaps should be reiterated at this moment, as we are at the brink of what could be an intense period of confrontation in the Middle East. The first is that we at the Duran have been expecting a further attack on Iran ever since the end of the June 2025 12-day war. We said at the time that the objective of that operation was clearly a decapitation strike of Iran's leadership intended to result in regime change in Iran. However, the leadership survived the decapitation strike, which took place on the same day, and regime change in Iran did not happen. The offensive, the military offensive against Iran had to be called off after 12 days when Israel and the United States began to run short of missiles, specifically air defense missiles. And once it became increasingly clear that Iranian ballistic missiles were penetrating Israeli defences and were successfully striking Israeli targets. The result was a ceasefire, but it was always clear that this was a pause rather than an end to the conflict. It was a certainty, given that regime change was obviously the objective, that Israel and the United States would come back and renew the assault on Iran. Speaking for myself, I expected the attack to come earlier. I had expected that the attack would happen before the end of 2025. Well, here we are on the last day of February, and February 2026, and it has now begun. This time, in contrast to the position back in June of last year, the United States, at least, is making no secret of its objective. Back in June 2025, the Israeli government also was making little secret of its objective. Israeli officials, Israeli media had long spoken about cutting off the head of the snake, as they put it, which clearly indicated a plan to achieve regime change in Iran. And as we pointed out on the Duran, and as I pointed out on this channel, clearly a decapitation strike against the Iranian leadership, which is what Israel attempted on the first day of the 12-day war, could have no other objective. However, the United States, which rode to Israel's rescue when it became clear that Israel was caught in a long drawn out war of attrition against Iran, which it was at serious risk of losing, the United States at that time was not openly advocating regime change. President Trump, this was back in June 2025, was instead insisting that it was all about Iran's nuclear program. It was exclusively about Iran's nuclear program. He harped on incessantly about the importance of ensuring that Iran never obtained a nuclear weapon, disregarding the fact that Iran did not have a nuclear weapon, that its enrichment program up to that time, up to the start of the 12-day war, had been closely monitored by the International Atomic Energy Agency. And though Iran had indeed enriched part of its uranium stockpile to dangerously high levels, this was only a result of President Trump's own decision to walk away from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, during his first term, which had effectively prevented Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon at any proximate time. Of course, over and above and beyond that, Iran has repeatedly denied any plan to acquire nuclear weapons. And there is, in fact, even a religious edict in existence to that effect. But anyway, going back to June 2025, that was President Trump's justification for the attack that the United States carried out on Iran at that time, the attack on the Iranian nuclear installations, enrichment installations in Fordow, Isfahan and Natanz. They were justified, they were rationalized as intended to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons and from dismantling Iran's nuclear program. In fact, President Trump claimed that that program had been obliterated. Well, this time, even though President Trump still talks about Iran seeking to acquire nuclear weapons in ways that sit uncomfortably with his earlier assertions after the June 2025 attack that Iran's nuclear program had been completely obliterated. Anyway, this time, President Trump is making no secret that it is regime change that he and Israel are after. He has called on the Iranian people to rise up and overthrow the government of Iran. He has incited mutinies within the Iranian armed forces. He has said that any Iranian military unit that defects will enjoy immunity presumably from action against the United States. And he has made spectacular threats against every part of the Iranian military, which on the contrary continues to remain loyal to the Iranian government. So the clear, the obvious objective is regime change, which is what, to repeat, we on the Duran have been saying all along. And in one respect, this attack, the one that has taken place today, mirrors exactly the attack which took place on the first day of the 12-day war. We are still at a very early stage of the attack. It's difficult to separate fact from fiction. There are all sorts of claims and counterclaims and rumours flying around. But it's clear from what the more reliable or maybe not perhaps the more reliable, but let's say the better informed Western news agencies like Reuters are telling us that the initial targets, again, were the Iranian leadership, the Iranian political and military leadership. Ayatollah Khamenei's compound in Tehran was attacked. So were other important government buildings, the Iranian High Court, the judiciary offices, apparently President Pezeshkian's offices, all sorts of important government centres were attacked. However, for the moment, the current information is that though some Iranian military commanders have been killed in the initial strikes, that there is sparse information about this. Anyway, though some Iranian military commanders may have been killed in the initial strikes, the numbers killed are far less than on the first day of the 12-day war, and that the major political leaders, Khamenei, Pezeshkian, other members, top members of the government, and of course the foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, are alive and safe. So it looks as if the initial decapitation strike failed. This is not to suggest that this is over. Presumably over the next week or longer, for as long as this operation continues, the United States will try to hunt all of these Iranian leaders. We could be seeing strikes on all sorts of compounds and facilities across Iran. Reuters is saying that they have been told by an Iranian official that Khamenei has been moved to a safe location outside Tehran. The United States will be trying to identify what that safe location is. Of course, it's not impossible that this information provided to Reuters by supposedly an Iranian official is itself a piece of misdirection. But anyway, one can't for the moment say that the decapitation strike, the attempt to decapitate Iran's leadership, is over. And, well, we might see some attack of that kind take place over the next couple of days or weeks. Though, in advance of this attack, the Iranian authorities had already taken steps to create redundancy within their leadership, to decentralize it as far as possible, to make it robust and resilient in anticipation of the attack which has now come. Now, here I'm going to just make a number of observations. Firstly, I'm going to start with an observation of my own. It's been clear to me that there is a notable lack of enthusiasm for this attack from within sections of the American government. It seems that the president has twice called off this attack at the last moment. There are reports, and I believe these reports, I give them credence, that General Kane and the Joint Chiefs of Staff advised the president a week ago that they could not guarantee the success of the operation. The president came away apparently extremely frustrated and angry from this meeting, and he was further angered by the reports that were circulating in the media, which had clearly been briefed by people acting on behalf of General Kane and other officials. That's my view, but I stand by it, about what the generals and the intelligence people had briefed the president. Anyway, he was clearly angered by it. He claimed that the story was fake news in a Truth Social post. But it was striking that the military leadership, General Kane and his officials, did not come out with statements supporting what the president had said. So there's clearly misgivings about this whole operation by sections of the military leadership, but that the president nonetheless was determined to carry on, that he was determined to push forward with this strike, despite warnings that it might fail. Well, for me, any lingering doubts about that basically went away after I listened to and then read the comments about Iran that the president made over the course of his State of the Union address. I've discussed them already in previous programs. I've said how the comments about Iran, relatively short as they were a litany of extraordinary assertions, all of which, in my opinion, were verifiably untrue, accusing Iran of practically every sin under the sun. By the way, the president's first address, the one that he published this morning, on Truth Social, incidentally, to me, was eerily similar in that regard. And he also spoke about Iran, the current Iranian government, as having seized power over a proud nation 47 years ago, words that clearly called into question the government's legitimacy. He referred to Iran as the prime sponsor of terrorism in the world, a massively controversial and, in my opinion, untrue statement. He alleged that the Iranian government had sinister motivations. It seemed to me absolutely clear, reading those words, listening to him speak, that in his own mind he had made a decision to attack Iran, and that despite the contrary advice that he was being given, the warnings he was being given by some of his political advisers about the deep unpopularity of this venture amongst the American people and on the part of his own base, that he was determined to press on. Now, here I'm going to say something, which is that I wonder whether possibly President Trump has again been given reassuring information by Prime Minister Netanyahu and his officials, which he has preferred to the advice of his own military and security advisers. I say that because it's clear to me that back in June 2025, President Trump received assurances from the Israelis that they would be able to carry out successfully a decapitation strike against the Iranian leadership, and that they would be able to do this by themselves, that Israel would be able to reproduce against Iran what Israel had succeeded in doing against Hamas and Hezbollah, and that President Trump believed this, that he thought that Prime Minister Netanyahu's assurances that a decapitation strike against Iran would succeed was true. And I wonder whether, over the last few months, since the attack in June, Prime Minister Netanyahu has been giving President Trump further assurances that there is huge opposition to the government within Iran itself, that the Iranian people and their tens of millions will come out on the streets to support any American and Israeli operation intended to cause the government's overthrow, that there are military units in Iran that are ready to switch sides. I saw that the US journalist Seymour Hersh, who clearly has contacts within the US intelligence community. Anyway, I saw that in his last piece, he spoke about contacts that the Israelis and the Americans have with military commanders inside Iran who have indicated that they're prepared to switch sides and to act against Ayatollah Khamenei. I wonder whether President Trump has been given all of those assurances, has been told that this is indeed going to happen, and that he has launched into this operation, defying, as I said, the advice of many of his advisers, on the assumption that this information he is getting from Prime Minister Netanyahu and from his officials, and whatever members of the American political and security state support Prime Minister Netanyahu in these assertions, that these assertions are true. Now, if so, this is a gamble. Prime Minister Netanyahu's assurances about a successful decapitation strike in June last year proved to be wrong, proved to be untrue. Apparently, there are doubts about this within the highest levels of the American government today. According to reports, at the meeting last Sunday, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, John Ratcliffe, supported General Kane in saying that there could be no guarantee that a regime change operation in Iran would be successful, which may suggest that there are people within the US intelligence community that are not convinced that there is indeed this split within the Iranian elite, that military units are indeed preparing to change sides, that there is widespread treason, in other words, at the highest level of the Iranian government. And, well, if these assurances that President Trump might have been given about these things turn out to be wrong, well, he has taken the United States on an incredibly dangerous and risky enterprise for which there is no obvious off-ramp. Now, in saying all of this, I have discussed in many previous programs how it has been clear to me for several years now that there has indeed been deep penetration and infiltration of Iranian security agencies by the United States and Israel. So, as of this moment in time, I cannot definitely say, despite the apparent doubts of Director Ratcliffe and maybe the leadership of the CIA, I cannot definitely say that expectations, fears that there could be disloyalty within the Iranian armed forces and within wider Iranian society are wrong. They might indeed turn out to be true. There is ample evidence, as I said previously, to suspect that there has indeed been deep penetration by Israel and the United States of Iran. But I obviously am in no position today to assess how deeply that penetration has gone. However, I have to say that as of this time, as of this particular moment in time, there is no visible sign of any breaking of ranks within Iran itself. My guess, and it can only be a guess, is that the key moment will come probably tonight. If there is going to be a move against the Iranian government, if some military unit is going to try to take action against Khamenei and Iran's religious, political and military leadership, then my guess is that it will need to be either tonight or on some night over the next couple of days. If a week from now the Iranian government is intact and is still functioning, then it will no longer be possible to say that whatever assurances President Trump may have been given about disloyalty within the Iranian elite and its military leadership and on the part of its armed forces or within wider Iranian society are true. At which point, this entire operation, the one we're seeing play out now, will begin increasingly to look like a risky, a disastrously risky gamble, which is going badly wrong. So this conflict that we're seeing today is a test of endurance. Firstly, a test of endurance by Iran. Iran, as I am making this video, is striking back. It is doing exactly what Iranian officials said they would do before the initial attack on Iran. The Iranians are striking American bases across the Middle East. They've struck bases in Kuwait, Bahrain, Iraq, apparently Jordan, the UAE, and Saudi Arabia. There's been strikes on the big American military base close to Riyadh. It looks as if Iranian missiles have been able to get through and have done real damage to some of these bases. The word is that most of the American military personnel had been evacuated. The Iranian media and the Iranian government are still holding together and are still indicating that they remain defiant. But we are still in the early hours of this operation, the first serious test of Iran's endurance will come tonight. And obviously, the next couple of days, the next week or so, will be critical. If Iran is able to endure through this first week, then the pendulum of endurance will shift, and it will become a test not of Iran's endurance any further, but rather a test of that of the United States and Israel. And here we have had a cascade of information from multiple sources about a lack of endurance capability by the United States. Shortages of air defense missiles. They were already demonstrated at the time of the 12-day war. The United States has run down its Patriot missile stockpiles to critically low levels as a result of its shipping of these missiles in profligate quantities to Ukraine and of the US's own inability to produce these sort of missiles in sufficient volumes, both to supply Ukraine and to build up or even rebuild its own stockpiles. And beyond that, the strikes that Iran itself conducted on Israel and the United States also significantly ran down stockpiles of air defense missiles during the 12-day war. And there's been further problems with missile stockpiles, air defense missile stockpiles being run down as a result of the operations against the Houthis, and of course, as a result of the longer conflict that Israel itself has been waging since the events of 7th October 2023. So there is a shortage of air defense systems, and it seems that there is also a shortage of offensive systems. Now, a number of people have added up the numbers and have concluded that if one looks at all of the various surface ships that the United States has deployed in and around Iran, the Ali Burke destroyers, and if one takes into account the Ohio cruise missile submarine, which is also said to be lurking in the Eastern Mediterranean, or is it perhaps the Arabian Sea? I am not sure. The United States can launch against Iran perhaps 600 to 800 Tomahawk cruise missiles. Against a country like Iran, that doesn't seem to me to be anywhere near enough. For the record, I believe that I'm right in saying that the Russians have launched well over 10,000 missiles of various types against Ukraine since the start of the special military operation. Just saying. Of course, not all of these have been cruise missiles like the Tomahawk, but the Russians certainly have launched hundreds of KH-101 subsonic cruise missiles and Calibre cruise missiles, which closely resemble, in some respects, the Tomahawks. And of course, the Russians have also launched other missiles, more devastating missiles, possibly like the Kinjal hypersonic missiles. And of course, the monstrously huge and powerful KH-22s and 32s. And that has not been sufficient to destroy completely Ukraine. Iran, which has a much bigger, more diversified population than Ukraine does, which has enormous territory, much of it heavily mountainous, which has presumably taken steps to fortify and harden many of its bases in ways that one suspect Ukraine has not done, and which, of course, has a previous history of withstanding prolonged missile attacks and bombing raids, as it did during the 8-year war with Iraq in the 1980s. It seems to me most unlikely, if this is purely a question of military force, that the United States can succeed against Iran with just 600 to 800 Tomahawk missiles. Of course, there are other missiles too. Israel also has a significant missile arsenal. So does the United States. There's been talk, for example, of the United States launching JASSMs missiles against Iran. No doubt that is exactly what the United States would do. I believe that there are large numbers of these missiles available. But again, the number is not unlimited. The United States has to consider that it is also in a conflict with other powers, notably China, in the South and East China Seas and in the Taiwan Straits. It has to balance what it can achieve against Iran against the necessity of preserving missile stockpiles in light of the ongoing Chinese build-up in the Asia-Pacific region, the United States, simply in terms of missiles, may not have an unlimited capability. And I discussed in a recent program how studies, both by the CSIS in the United States and by the Israelis, concluded that the United States can conduct an intense air and missile campaign against Iran on the scale of the operation that was carried out against Iraq in 1998, Operation Desert Fox, for perhaps around 5 days. Operation Desert Fox lasted for 4 days. That this could perhaps be spun out longer, but that would need a more careful and limited tempo in the use of offensive missiles. But even then, it might be difficult to sustain operations for more than perhaps a week or possibly 2 weeks at maximum. So, is this enough time? Are these resources sufficient to topple the government of Iran? Well, I come back to what I said. It's Iran's internal stability that will determine this outcome. If Iran is still standing in a week or 2 weeks' time, then precisely because of the information that we have about limited American endurance, the pendulum will start to shift, and the problems for the president and his officials will begin. And then, of course, we enter into completely uncharted territory, because in June, when the original 12-day war began to go wrong, the United States had an off-ramp. President Trump could declare that the strikes against Fordow, Natanz, and Isfahan had been a brilliant, outstanding, extraordinary, unqualified success, that the entire Iranian nuclear program had been obliterated, that anybody who denied this was engaging in action almost amounting to treason. It's worthwhile, by the way, going back and reviewing what he was saying at that time. Of course, now he's essentially admitting that the attack on Iran in June might not have been as decisive, anywhere near as decisive, as he was claiming then. But the point is, he had an off-ramp then. He could claim victory. And the Iranians at that time, who had been caught by surprise by his attack, they agreed to a ceasefire. But what if this time the Iranian calculus is different? As the Iranians are themselves saying, as they've briefed, for example, the Financial Times, as has been said by multiple Iranian officials, what if once the Americans weaken and the Israelis weaken, once it becomes increasingly clear that they lack air defense capabilities, which might, by the way, require a pullback of American warships from the American Sea? What if Iran's ability to strike targets in Israel continues and escalates? What if Iran rejects requests for a ceasefire? What does the president at that point do? What does the United States do if they find themselves in that kind of position, what leverage do they have over Iran in that case? Is Iran even interested in negotiations or ceasefires, given the pattern of activity as we've seen it play out since the original Israeli strikes on Iranian targets in 2024? What if the Iranians say that they will only stop if the United States itself makes concessions, dismantling its bases, for example, in the Gulf, withdrawing its forces from the Gulf, or if the Israelis start making even stronger demands, demands that they be given an unqualified right, as they have under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, to engage in an enrichment program? What does the United States do in that case? Well, we shall see. We are not at that point yet, and I am not going to speculate too far ahead. I know that there are all sorts of very alarming possibilities. I've seen some extraordinary claims that Trump, the United States, for example, decided to intervene in the conflict between Israel and Iran in June because they got word that unless they did, Israel was seriously considering using nuclear weapons. I'm not sure, by the way, that I believe that story. I retain the hope and belief that the United States has a kill switch over any Israeli action of that kind. But that's purely a matter of belief. I don't know. And then there is, of course, the further question of the domestic pressures against President Trump himself. In a recent program, in fact, a program that Alex and I did on the Duran yesterday, we discussed a possible off-ramp for Donald Trump. This is, of course, made before the attack which has taken place today. An off-ramp that the president might seek in order to avoid the attack that we are seeing now. I said, and I don't think there's any doubt about this, that I couldn't myself see that Donald Trump wanted or was even looking for an off-ramp. It seemed to me that he had made a decision to attack Iran, that he was confident of success, and that he was not really thinking about an off-ramp at all. My view, especially after the State of the Union address, was that the talks that were taking place in Geneva were mostly for show, and that there was no real substance to them, and that the entire purpose of the talks was basically to try to find some way to get American public opinion, which has made no secret of its hostility to an attack on Iran, to try to get American public opinion on side. Others are saying the same thing. Consider, for example, what Dmitry Medvedev, Russia's former president, former prime minister, current vice chair of Russia's Security Council, and de facto head of Russia's Military Industrial Commission. What he has said in a post he has published today. The peacekeeper, he is of course ironically referring to Trump, the peacekeeper is at it again. The talks with Iran were just a cover. Everyone knew that. everyone? Well, we will come to that in a moment. But anyway, that is what Medvedev said. So the president wasn't looking for an off-ramp before he launched his attack on Iran. He was trying to prepare the ground, the opinion in the United States for a war against Iran. He's going to make another address to the American people shortly, also to press home his call for a war against Iran. So he has not been looking for an off-ramp up to this time. If the war is still continuing in 2 weeks' time, if the Iranians start escalating, if they start taking even more radical steps, like, for example, closing the Straits of Hormuz, something which they have recently rehearsed doing, I discussed that in a recent program, the president will find himself in a situation where he will have lost control of the situation. And he has no off-ramp because he kicked the off-ramp away. What then does he do? Well, again, I am not going to anticipate. I could see how this could develop into an enormous crisis. The crisis, in fact, has only just begun. To repeat again, it's a test of endurance. At the moment, it is Iran that has to show it is able to endure. Tonight is going to be critical. The next few nights and days are going to be important as well. But if Iran gets through, the pendulum will change. Now, I will say that in Europe, there seems to be less than overwhelming enthusiasm for this operation. President Macron of France, of whom perhaps little need be said, is calling for an immediate stop to the conflict. The Saudis and other Gulf states who had the nightmare of having American bases on their own territory attacked, are also clearly looking for an end. They've issued a statement which, contrary to what some reports say, did not mention an attack by these states against Iran or seek to attack Iran. But then the dynamics of this conflict are very complicated. And, well, the Russians and the Chinese have both condemned this attack. And, of course, the other thing to say is that the longer this war continues, the greater their influence becomes, the greater their leverage over the United States will become. Before long, I expect China, perhaps quietly, to stop again supplies of rare earths to the United States. China is already clearly providing intelligence to Iran. And, well, there's no guessing what China and Russia are doing altogether. I've discussed much of this in recent programs. To repeat once more again, there is only so much China and Russia can do if Iran cannot endure the test of, let's say, the next 2 weeks. Anyway, there it is. This is the situation today. I'm going to finish these comments by making one very quick observation. I've made it already, but in previous programs, but I'm going to make it again. This is an entirely unnecessary attack. Iran does not have a nuclear weapons capability. Iran has repeatedly said it does not want a nuclear weapons capability. The supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, has firmly rejected the idea of Iran acquiring a nuclear weapons capability. Incidentally, if the United States and Israel are successful in killing him over the next few weeks, as he apparently expects, that was something that was discussed in the Financial Times, then it must not be assumed that any successor who replaces him will be as unwilling to acquire nuclear weapons, as inhibited in acquiring nuclear weapons as he was. I remember an Iranian official, an advisor of Khamenei, giving an interview on Iranian television in which he said that the only thing that stopped, that was preventing Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapons capability, was Khamenei's categorical prohibition against doing so. Just saying. So, anyway, that's a topic to discuss some other day. But anyway, Iran does not have a nuclear capability. It has said repeatedly that it is not interested in acquiring a nuclear capability. Over the last decade, it has been cooperating, at least it was cooperating, up to the June 2025 12-day war with the International Atomic Energy Agency, which was supervising its nuclear sites. It was not attacking Israel when it was attacked, up to today when it was attacked. It has never proactively attacked Israel. Instead, it has responded to Israeli attacks upon itself. There was never any cause or pretext or justification of this war, which is being entirely waged because Prime Minister Netanyahu and his government have wanted for decades to overthrow the current government and political system of Iran. I cannot see that any compelling American security interest is engaged by this war. I cannot see that the United States achieves any strategic objective through this war. I think that this war qualifies as a straightforward act of aggression by the United States and Israel against Iran. I get pushback from some people when I say this, but I defy anyone to look at the facts and seriously argue otherwise. Anyway, this is what I'm going to say about this conflict today. Now, I'm going to turn briefly at the end of this programme to a quick discussion of the situation in Ukraine. It is now confirmed that the Russians refused to have a further meeting with the Ukrainians and Americans in Geneva. And this is why the meeting that was supposed to happen on Thursday never took place. The Russians said that they were never happy having the meeting in Geneva or in Switzerland at all. They do not accept that Switzerland is a truly neutral country. They were annoyed by the fact that the last meeting took place in Geneva, because that suited Witkoff's and Kushner's travel arrangements, because those two gentlemen were shuttling from one meeting to another. And the Russians said that if there was going to be a further meeting, it needed to take place in Abu Dhabi as before, otherwise it wouldn't happen at all. Of course, now that the entire Middle East is in flames, a meeting in Abu Dhabi, I would have thought, was impossible. So anyway, that's why there was no meeting. I mentioned just a moment ago Dmitry Medvedev's comment about this attack and the American duplicity in the conduct of the negotiations. To repeat his words again, the peacekeeper, i.e. Donald Trump, is at it again. The talks with Iran were just a cover. Everyone knew that. I have spoken many, many times about the fact that it seemed to me that there were increasing doubts in Moscow on the part of more and more people about the wisdom of continuing negotiations with the Americans and the Ukrainians, that many people in Moscow, after the Anchorage agreement, about which they were less than enthusiastic anyway, were feeling that Trump was simply stringing Putin along, that Putin was persuaded by Trump and Witkoff to come to Anchorage to meet Trump, that Trump and Witkoff gave Putin a proposal which appeared to satisfy most Russian objectives and concerns in the special military operation, requiring the Russians to make some minor concessions on peripheral matters. Many Russian officials, I think it is now clear, thought that was altogether too good to be true. I've never forgotten the faces, the film of Putin's meeting with the officials of the Security Council after the Anchorage meeting, in which Putin briefed them on his discussions and supposed agreements with Trump. And I've never forgotten the cold look on all of the faces of the officials who were listening to Putin. It's been obvious to me that for a long time there have been doubts on the part of many people in Moscow about the utility of this process. Medvedev himself has previously posted messages after the sanctions on Lukoil and Rosneft, saying that there was no point in clinging to the illusion that Trump was really interested in peace and that he was anything other than an enemy. And here we have Medvedev posting again, saying that the peacekeeper is obviously not a peacekeeper at all, that the talks were all a cover, that there was no good faith behind them at all, and that everybody knew that. Everybody? What about Putin? I mean, that is perhaps the question that is now hanging over all of this, because I can't help but think that Medvedev's comment, which is obviously about Iran, may also reflect his views about the talks between Russia, the United States, the negotiations that have taken place as well. Trump cannot be trusted. He is duplicitous. He is cynical. He makes promises, as he did to Putin in Anchorage, that he not only cannot deliver on, but has no intention of ever delivering on. And that's Medvedev's view. And I have no doubt that there are many other people in Moscow, including on the Security Council, who agree with Medvedev about all of this. Trump may not realise it, but this latest attack on Iran has strengthened the doubts, the position of people like Medvedev in Moscow. That, of course, assumes that Putin himself remains engaged in this enterprise of negotiations. About that, I have also my own doubts, by the way. I've spoken about how it seemed to me that comments made by Ushakov and Putin himself seemed to suggest a hardening of the Russian position. Certainly the rhetoric from the Russians, as demonstrated by a series of comments and interviews given by Sergei Lavrov, also suggested a hardening of the Russian position. And well, beyond that, it seems to me that we've now had a further demonstration of the real mood in Moscow. Because yesterday, a farcical event took place. One of Emmanuel Macron's top people tried to telephone the Kremlin to speak to some important official there. He did exactly the same thing as Macron did to the fury of the Russians some years ago. He had all of the French media there. He dialed the Kremlin 5 times, but the Kremlin refused to take the call. They didn't answer. Well, you can read that as you wish. The Russians losing sympathy with Macron, having given up on Macron himself. But it seems to me that at the very least, it suggests that the mood in Moscow at the present time, and bear in mind this happened before the attack on Iran, the mood in Moscow is extremely unaccommodating, and I'm putting it mildly. And notice again that Putin himself has had nothing very much to say about the negotiations. The last we heard is about negotiations over the Ukraine issue from Putin was following his meeting with Kushner and Witkoff in the Kremlin on the 23rd of January. And it turns out that Putin and the Russians were infuriated when Witkoff and Kushner came to that meeting, but did not bring the security guarantee document that the Americans have been negotiating behind the Russians' back with the Ukrainians with them, causing Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, to complain about that fact in several public comments. So anyway, that's what I want to say about that. Now, very briefly, the war continues. There's been more information about further significant Russian advances in eastern Zaporozhye. The fact that the Russians continue to advance towards Orekhov, to my mind, absolutely does call into question the entire claim that the Ukrainians have mounted some kind of successful counteroffensive in northeast Zaporozhye region. If there was a successful Ukrainian counteroffensive there, surely the Russians would not be able to continue to advance towards Orekhov. Just saying. The Russians have also apparently made further big advances in Konstantinovka. In fact, the Ukrainian defences there, as I discussed in my programme yesterday, are tottering. And in the Liman area, we've now seen footage, apparently, of a Russian flag, and some say also Russian soldiers, though I haven't seen this footage, showing the Russians in control of the small town of Dobyshevo, which is located north of Liman. The Ukrainians had held this place for some time. It was apparently one of the obstacles the Russians needed to overcome before they captured Liman itself. If this footage is what it appears to be, then it looks as if the Russians have overcome this obstacle which probably seals the fate of Lima. So the special military operation grinds on. The expenditure of Western weapons to try to keep the Ukrainian army fighting goes on too. But obviously today, this morning, the focus is on the situation in the Gulf, this battle between the United States and Israel on the one side and Iran on the other. To repeat again, tonight is going to be very important. There are reports that the Iranian security forces are out on the streets in Iran in preparation for any trouble. We will see what comes. If Iran is still there tomorrow, it will be a further sign that this operation is not going according to plan. But we can only say that definitely after about a week or two. We have a long nail-biting period of several weeks, and we will see how things play out in that time. Well, this is where I finish today's programme. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar. And please also remember to check out our Substack site. Links for all of these things under this video. Last but not least, please remember to check out our shop and also to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Back tomorrow.